Everybody, welcome to a special edition of Brain Trust, Conversations in Clinical Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg from the Icahn School of Medicine in Mount Sinai in New York. We are here today in beautiful Miami Beach for the American Society of Clinical Psychopharmacology annual meeting. I am joined by a number of my closest friends and colleagues from the ASCPD Prescribing Task Force in Psychopharmacology. And so this special edition program today is going to give us a unique roundtable opportunity to talk about some very topical issues and themes about deprescribing in psychopharmacology, which has become quite the national debate with lots of science and some non-science that's contributed to that. So I'm going to start by asking our colleagues and friends here to introduce ourselves. I'll start with Roger.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me as part of this. It's been great work with good friends and colleagues. Roger McIntyre, professor of psychiatry and professor of pharmacology at Toxicology University of Toronto. So fun to be part of this with you guys.
Hi, I'm Raj Mago. I'm a professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University, a clinical professor. And I'm an editor of an educational website, simpleandpractical.com.
Hi, I'm Anita Clayton. I'm a professor in psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences and a professor of clinical obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Virginia.
And I'm Holly Swartz. I'm a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh.
I'm David Goodman. I'm an adult psychiatrist specializing in adult ADHD. I'm a clinical associate professor at SUNY Upstate and also on faculty at Johns Hopkins Hospital.
I'm Lisa Troma. I'm a psychiatrist from Chicago, Illinois. I'm clinical professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at New York Medical College in Valhalla, New York, and adjunct professor at the Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago.
Hi, I'm Mauricio Toan. I'm a psychiatrist and an epidemiologist. I am the chairperson of the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of New Mexico.
Fantastic. So thank you all for joining us today. Let's jump right in. You all have been integral leaders in the ASCP efforts to educate our colleagues and help further knowledge and understanding about deprescribing, that is the judicious, thoughtful, supervised, purposeful, intentional, clinically indicated decision-making process by which a clinician determines that an existing medicine within the treatment regimen of a given patient with a mental health condition is inappropriate for one reason or another and ought to consider taking it away and maybe replacing it with something better. So I'd like to start by asking you, why has this become so important and a topic of national dialogue and debate?
Well, Joe, I think part of the problem is the variety of care that people get, and they may end up on medicines that actually don't help them, and they may get ill effects from them, right? And that's generalized to everyone on that medicine or with that illness. That's a problem. If medicines were prescribed in a way that they ought to be, then they should help and not harm. And if they don't help, they should be replaced by something else for that individual person. But that doesn't always take place. And people are on medicines that don't work for long periods of time. And people get disillusioned.
So medicines are sometimes bad, or the prescribers are sometimes remiss?
Or there's an absence of education. I mean, at this point, 20 years ago, most of the psychotropic medications were prescribed by psychiatrists trained in the art and science of prescribing these medications. 20 years later, you now have a broad range of prescribers with varying degrees of training and background and clinical experience before they're out in the field. And so there is a lack of understanding of how to go about making accurate diagnosis and then prescribing, in addition to the time limitations placed on clinicians to quickly see the patient, make a diagnosis, give them a medication, and then move to the next patient.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with David on that. And I think that the way I thought about this, Joe, is it's been like a supply and demand mismatch. The demand for mental health services has exploded the last two, three decades, especially the last two decades. And then commensurate with that time, what we've seen is a lack of the supply side to keep up with this. And the supply side, meaning the system to provide just-in-time healthcare and quality healthcare, So for me, the deprescribing initiative really has an overarching sort of banner. For me, it's quality. And what we have seen is departure from quality. I'm not sure it's more now than it was 20 years ago, but it's certainly egregious right now.
We've always stopped and started. Medicine, we've never talked about the process.
Right, but what happens is, to David's point, I think, is that because you have such balkanization and discoordination of the healthcare system, there's many, many points, including the internet, where people are accessing treatment without really an overseeing sort of most responsible healthcare provider. And I think that's a major aspect that's driven some of the polypharmacy, the inappropriate polypharmacy that we talk about. So I think it starts with systems and structure, the precariousness of the life of the people with mental illness and having timely access to healthcare. That's created fertile ground for what we have.
Right. But I agree with everything that people have said so far. I mean, certainly those are things that we have been very concerned about and have been discussing for a while. But I just want to add to that another aspect that we have also been discussing, which is that it's difficult. So why do they continue on medication when it is not working? It's partly because it's very difficult. So when the person comes to you with a list of medication, I'm a clinician. 50% of the time I spend face to face seeing patients. I find it not so easy to say which medicine helped the person. Mm-hmm. Many cases they've been on them for years. Yeah. So we don't know which ones, and it has to be done cautiously. Patients are very averse if they are doing well. The patient doesn't want to change, the family doesn't want to change the medicine, the doctor doesn't want to change the medicine. So circling back to where you started, I have understood deep prescribing, Joe, as under your leadership, like we've been working on this, that it's not the same as just stopping a medicine that doesn't work. It's a dedication to the process, acknowledging that people are on medications, which could be interacting, some of which may be unnecessary. Maybe it can be simplified. Maybe some changes need to be made. So recognizing that, but also recognizing that there's a need for some kind of process and more thought, not simply saying that you guys have been giving inappropriate medicine and you need to stop doing that.
Researchers think about, I'm doing a clinical trial. I'm using metrics. I have a time frame in mind. I have milestones. And if by this point I haven't seen this quantifiable degree of improvement, I will then make the determination of efficacy, yes or no, from which I'll then move on. Do you think part of the problem is that the clinicians don't think that way? And if they did, maybe this would feel more organic?
Actually, Joe, I think you define deep prescribing. Let's also make sure that we define what is not deep prescribing. Deep prescribing is not what antipsychiatry has promoted, which is no medication. That is not. For that matter, recently the Secretary of Health made some statements that we agree on. Two key statements. Number one, the best treatment for individuals with psychiatric condition is not just medication. It should also include a good diet and exercise. We agree 100%. The other thing that he mentioned was more medications is not necessarily better, and we should only keep those that work. We also agree 100%. For that matter, we talked about clinical practice. Deprescribing is good clinical practice, and it should happen every time we see a patient. Okay, I see my patient. Is he or she or they are taking these medications. So should they be continuing to taking the same medications? I don't know. Side effects. Are we having new side effects? For that matter, has the diagnosis changed? Mm-hmm. Not necessarily that we made the wrong diagnosis. A beautiful example is psychotic depression. Psychotic depression, especially at the beginning, will change. And it evolves to bipolar disorder, schizoaffective disorder. So it's not that we made the wrong diagnosis initially. It's that the diagnosis has evolved and therefore treatment has changed. So again, I would say good clinical practice is to, every time we see our patient, is to think about, should this patient continue this or that medication or not?
Are we not
back to you, Joe?
I was just going to say, I mean, I think this is absolutely right. And in some ways, this is, you know, kind of a duh thing, right? So everything is new again, as Joe has mentioned, this is something that we've been doing all along and should be doing all along. But it, you pointed out that there's a tension now between the framework for deprescribing that has been inappropriately appropriated by those who would say, no medication is good. We should get rid of all medication versus the way that the mental health community thinks about deprescribing, which is a taking a systematic approach to evaluating best practices, whether it involves substituting, stopping, reconceptualizing. And so I think the one of the important points that we should make is that, as you did, this is not about stopping all medication, but it's also in response to kind of a growing movement that's out there saying that that's what mental health should be all about.
Misinterpreting the term itself, because it's used elsewhere in medicine. I mean, if there are redundant treatments, contradictory treatments, obsolete treatments, a treatment that's run its course, ineffective treatments, I mean, neurology does this, gastroenterology does this, hardly is it new. And yet in psychiatry, we act as if it's new.
Well, also, it's a solution to a very different problem. And so then it doesn't actually work as a solution. The problem is that the vast majority of medications given for psychiatric conditions are prescribed by primary care providers. They're pretty good at figuring out that someone has depression or anxiety. They're not very good. And they're also, in their practice, not given the opportunity. They don't see people often enough. They have a short period of time with them. They don't get the opportunity to follow them as closely as they should be and to change their meds if they're not working, or increase the dose, which we frequently see people at the starting dose after years, and it's not effective for them. Also, there's not a lot of measurement-based care being used in primary care practices, and then it's hard to tell, well, how much have they improved? And they may not say exactly what's going on to their provider. They don't want to bother them, or they think I'm just whining, or whatever is going on in the head of the patient, but also the provider doesn't have much time and they don't spend time pulling it out of them.
So there has to
and
be.
Act on it.
Yeah.
So Joe, when I was in residency, just after the Tyrannosaurus rex went extinct, I was taught that what gets the patient well keeps the patient well. And there wasn't a consideration of tapering or deprescribing with stability of 3, 4, 5 years. So that's part of the psychiatric training decades ago. But to Anita's point, and that is over 90% of antidepressants are prescribed by primary care, 50% of stimulants are prescribed by non-psychiatrists. And these people are not educated on the fact that at some point you need to reconsider whether or not the polypharmacy you've prescribed is appropriate and necessary.
You know, it's hard to do when a primary care provider is treating someone for psychiatric disorder. They're likely treating them also for hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and so on. And it's easy to measure those things. You take the blood pressure, and if it's elevated, you have to do something different. If the lipids are higher, you need to do something different. I like Anita's mention of measurement-based care. Thankfully, many primary care people do the PHQ-9 and could actually change the treatment if they don't see progress, but not always. And sometimes it's a situation where things are kind of the same. They're not good, but they're kind of the same. And people are sometimes satisfied with kind of the same. Now, the patient may not be satisfied, but you know, there's no emergency here. It is kind of an attitude that's quite common.
So, plus, they don't have a comparison. They only have themselves. They're an N of one for themselves. So they don't know to say, hey, I'm not feeling this, that, or the other thing, or I'm not well. I'm not myself. I can't work. And maybe they try to say some of those things, but often, again, it's these time limitations that really get in the way.
So can I ask, many of the conditions that we treat are chronic and recurrent, and unfortunately, our treatments, while better than placebos, tend not to have gigantic effect sizes. And so we can see residual symptoms. And there may sometimes occur the instance in which a patient themselves might attribute some sense of their suffering to their treatment itself and come to you and say, you know, I'm not feeling well in this way. I think it's because of your medicine. And so why don't we take away your medicine? Do you all find that to be the case? And if so, when so, how do you have a dialogue with the patient about knowing what is the condition that's undertreated as opposed to something that the treatment itself is responsible for causing?
Well, you know, your question, Joe, for me actually brings up, you know, I really think that, again, going back to my point, I think this is really a statement about quality, coherence, and supply and demand mismatch in the system. And, you know, I agree with you that there's also an aspect around provider confidence, provider experience, provider capabilities, frankly. Mm-hmm. And what you're touching on, I think, Joe, is also an issue we always encounter. And to me, it comes into issue of literacy. And, you know, most people are going on TikTok, they're going on Instagram to learn about mental illness. And there really is there's an anemic supply of high quality areas to go for education. And most patients that I have seen in 30, 35 years doing this with bipolar disorder and depression, the literacy is very low. The treatment literacy is also very, very low. And even when the treatment is not working, they develop this psychology. There's an attachment to the medications. And that's something I think maybe not unique to psychiatry, but certainly amplified in psychiatry. And those are aspects that time, you need, I think your point's well taken. This is time. And there's never enough time that clinicians have to deal with all these aspects. And I think these factors serve as conspirators in propagating the polypharmacy that we see. And Raj, to your point, you know, for studies that we do, we ask people to stop the medications they're on. The medications are useless. Medications are doing nothing for them observably. Yet it's almost like twisting their arm to get off these medications.
Maybe they have psychological importance.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I think that you mentioned the fact that people develop attachments to their medication. And I think some of this is driven by the psychology of the individuals taking medication, whether they feel like they need to, you know, maintain an attachment to their care providers by sort of ingesting these physical transition objects, if you will, if we're going back to psychoanalytic models, but it's powerful. And I mean, what primary care doctor is sitting there thinking, is this medication like functioning as a transitional object for my patient? So maybe what I need to do is engage them in more psychotherapy so that we can help address some of their underlying attachment issues, which, you know, there's just no capacity for this. And yet that's probably key to helping people successfully distinguish between their psychological relationship to the medication and their physiologic needs.
And for some people, aren't medicines tangible validations of suffering? Mm-hmm. Clearly, you're suffering. Let me give you something for it. Oh, let me take it away. What's the implication in terms of how I validate your experience?
Right.
Well, you know, a key thing is actually collaborative care. Mm-hmm. So we provide the information, but at the end of the day, it's going to be the patient and significant others who will be making the decision. For that matter, we might think that a certain side effect is really not a big deal, but for that person, it is.
Yeah.
Or to the significant other. So I think that is key in terms of deprescribing what we keep, what we don't. It can't be just us.
You can't deprescribe in a vacuum, right? I mean, there's data that says if you, there's much interest in discontinuation symptoms, and our leadership has talked about likening the discontinuation phenomena as if it was to a physical dependence on a substance. And interestingly, there are studies that say if you provide psychological support within the context of the discontinuation of the validator of the suffering, you get a better outcome. In fact, almost about as good as if you had continued the treatment. Is that fair to think?
I think these are, we're giving physiologically active substances to people, but as you said, it's not happening in a vacuum, right? So this is being done in a context of a provider-patient relationship, and that attending to those dynamics is absolutely important in terms of helping people navigate the challenges of managing their health conditions, or in this case, the in some cases side effects associated with tapering off of a medication.
Joe, there's a
David, then Raj.
There's another aspect. We're talking about deprescribing medications that we judge to no longer be effective for a diagnosed illness. We're not talking, and I would include, deprescribing medications when the diagnosis has not been accurately established. Mm-hmm. And so I want to go to the ADHD arena where telehealth has contributed to the diagnosis of ADHD inaccurately with inadequate evaluations. And now you have a patient with a diagnosis prescribed to medication who likes the medication, and the clinician who sees this patient again in follow-up, a second clinician, needs to do the evaluation in order to establish the legitimacy and accuracy of the original diagnosis. Otherwise, if the person really doesn't have ADHD, let's deprescribe this medication and have a discussion about why they originally sought care.
Can I just underscore what David just said? Because the word overprescribing has appeared in some media, and to your point, overprescribing might occur for the wrong diagnosis. I imagine there are some primary care doctors that overprescribe antibiotics for non-bacterial infections, or that might think about certain interventions that may be appropriate for you, but not for you. And so if overprescribing occurs, I think it comes right back to David's point about, is there an alignment between the prescribed treatment and the ailment? Because if not, then that is inappropriate.
I wanted to ask what the group thinks about, like, that another problem. We are focused on the idea that people are on multiple medications for a very long period with dubious, some with known are not helping or have dubious benefit. But isn't it also true that we have a lot of data that indicate that for common conditions like major depression and so on, more than 50% of the patients stop their medications before even the acute phase of treatment is over? So, And there was a study, you know, there's some data to indicate that people for whom there's a clear recommendation that they should take medication, antidepressant long term, they've had three or more severe episodes of depression and they should take medication preventively. 88%, I'm thinking of one particular study, 88% of those people were not taking the medication long term. So we have the exact opposite problem also of lack of persistence. So maybe we should not be thinking of deprescribing, but we have been talking about this amongst ourselves. It's a question of appropriate prescribing. Sometimes some people need to take it long term. Some people need to get off it completely. Some people need to take it for a medium duration, right?
Following up on appropriate prescribing.
Yes.
And it's not necessarily that the condition, the diagnosis will change, but it evolves. There's a concept that has been used a lot in bipolar disorder, which is treatment in stages. Would the treatment that you need at onset would be the same after a number of years or not? The other ones is medication side effects. As we know, lithium can be a great drug. It might work for a number of years, but unfortunately, long-term use will lead to side effects. Should you continue because it was a great medication then, but not now? No, there might be cases with deep prescribing because the patient has aged that we need to change the medication. So now, that needs to be something that we continue to evaluate.
Now, here's a risk you make me think of. If I have an initial presentation, let's say a bipolar disorder, and I'm successfully treated, say, with lithium, and I decide to take away the medicine, I might change the course of my illness in terms of evoking more episodes down the line. So if David wants to give me lithium down the line, it may not work as well. Isn't that true that one of the risks we have to make clear to our patients is that if you do make the decision to stop a medicine, it could change the course of your illness and make it less treatment responsive?
But what Mauricio is saying, I totally agree with that, that the issue of side effects, I think that in general, the prescribing clinicians are on the side of saying, well, what do you want to be depressed or do you want to be overweight? You have to, as if it was a choice, or you want to have sexual dysfunction, your Hobson's choice. But in fact, the patient says, how about neither? And they vote with their feet. I mean, the empirical data show that the huge majority of people with bipolar disorder do not continue to take their medication. We may keep insisting that the side effects are worth it, but the patients don't think so. They beg to disagree. And I wrote a review article a few years ago in Harvard Review of Psychiatry about, like, what are the side effects? Why do they stop? And the main two reasons were weight gain. Nobody likes weight gain. I would, you know, I don't know. I don't want to give an analogy of, like, but I would tolerate a lot of pain before I would accept weight gain. And another one is cognitive impairment. So anything cognitive. So I came up with two principles. One is that any cognitive is your identity.
And people don't like anything that makes them think that their identity is hampered. And benign tremors. That puzzled me a little bit. Benign tremors as a major reason for people with bipolar disorder permanently stopping their lithium. And the reason is that it's socially embarrassing. So you're at a party and you're holding this. In the old days, it was when they would sign a check. I had a patient who was a physician. He said that his residents would look at him as he was writing. He noticed that they were looking at his hand because of the benign tremor. So these three were found to be, in my review, the most important causes.
But Rush, a key point, it should be individualized. For some individuals, having sexual adverse events is the worst. For others, as you mentioned, the tremor. So this is why the importance of collaborating with the patient. Which one is the one that you would tolerate the most and the least? I agree with you.
So if we had to categorize, so what are we talking about? We're talking about deprescribing in the midst of an uncertain and inaccurate diagnosis, deprescribing as a function of the patient's request based on side effects or inefficacy. Clinician's perspective that the patient has been stable and perhaps the medication is no longer needed. We should put these into categories so that a clinician can walk through this in a decision tree.
I agree, David. And I think keep going with that. If there's actually a pharmacologic redundancy or countertherapeutic combination, patients would be expected to know that. And that quite commonly occurs. But, you know, I think that, you know, listening to how we're having this discussion, I tend to have a way in which my mind works where I'm just constantly just jumping to the solution. And so the solution is what? We're not going to obviously provide secure, timely access to healthcare for people that's high quality, integrated, coordinated, longitudinal. So I don't think it's going to happen. So I think that there are guiding principles, and the guiding principles have emerged from this conversation. These guiding principles, I don't think, are really up for debate and negotiation. That is, in fact, assured, David, your point, that there's been an effort at least to make a diagnosis that is at least supported. Mm-hmm. And second, whenever you are prescribing treatment, the iteration should continue thereafter. The iteration being, is this treatment at a very personal way? Is it benefiting? Is there risk? And that's a very personal calculus. I agree with Mercy on that.
We're talking also about, we need to educate patients so there are partners in their care. And if we say, okay, look, you have depression, and these are the main symptoms, and let's talk about what you want to avoid in terms of side effects, and then we'll put together a plan on what might be the best thing for us to initially start. And then we're going to track that so that we can sort out if you really are improving, because we want you well. And if you can really help with that point that you want people to reach, then I think they are on board, and they can come back and you go, well, really, you haven't improved. I mean, it's so minimal that, and you're on an adequate dose and you've been there for long enough that we should have seen a benefit.
Is pharmacology the only way to treat a mental health condition?
Well, no.
That's exactly what I was thinking. That, I'm sorry, that people who are depressed, does it necessarily mean that they should get a medication? I asked a leading psychopharmacology expert here at ASCP, that you give every single person you see who's depressed, you give them a medication. He said, yes. I wonder if what the group thinks. This is a difficult question, but so sorry to throw a hand grenade in them onto the table.
Better here than that. The psychiatrist, they expect you to give them medicine.
No, if you go to a psychiatrist, you expect them to either deliver or recommend treatments that are going to get you well.
Right. Yeah.
And there are many conditions for which psychotherapies are the first line treatment, right, or they're, you know, in head to head trials, comparable outcomes with pharmacotherapy and psychotherapy. And I think depression is one of them, but not the only one, or they're offered, or we have better outcomes when we combine them. So I think your point is very well taken, Raj, that we really need to think about in our algorithm where psychotherapy is being recommended recommended or not recommended. And when we think with patients about what their priorities are, psychotherapy should be entering into the discussion. But as we've been talking about in the mental health system, where psychotherapy is most typically provided, is overburdened. And so many of this is being task shifted to places where psychotherapy is not necessarily as accessible as it should be. So, you know, I think this goes back to access as well as what we're recommending and offering to our patients.
But this is America, just so I can say, this is America. People want a pill to fix them. Okay, they or they rapid, want a drug.
They want a rapid to fix solution.
To right, they do.
You come to experts for wisdom and guidance about what the right treatment is. I mean, if I have heart disease, does that automatically mean I get bypass surgery, or is there a stepped approach and I rely on my physician to guide me through
the process? It's worse than that. If I have chest pain, do I need bypass surgery? We don't even know whether the person has heart disease. I'm thinking of a patient whom I treated, and she went through various algorithms of treatment-resistant depression until we figured out that her husband was beating her, and that is what she was depressed about.
Raj. You know, on the question about, I mean, this hand grenade, I'm actually, you threw into the conversation, Raj. Do all depressed patients require an antidepressant? Yes and no. If a patient came to my office with major depressive disorder and psychosis, always they need a medication.
Yes.
So if they come in my office, they've just had a failed romantic relationship, lost a job, first time depressed, lots of resiliencies, good economics, nice bank account, and they got access to healthcare timely, no. So I think even within a heterogeneous diagnosis like MDD, I would say the answer is yes and no. It depends on the case.
Yeah.
But what I might say is this, is that in bipolar disorder, in schizophrenia, my answer is always yes.
Yes, correct.
No,
I would agree with that completely.
And you guys always spend a lot of my time working on trespass and obesity, and I think I'm an endocrinologist, but I've been working in diabetes my whole career. And what happened in obesity in the last 15, 20 years, I think it's very instructive to psychiatry. See, obesity management was always a pyramid with diet, education, exercise, motivation. If that failed, then medications. If that failed, then on to surgery. No more pyramids. They're pillars. It's pillars. So medication, psychotherapy, diet, and surgery are pillars because they recognize that the brain of people with obesity is preventing them from meaningfully engaging nutrition, exercise, motivation, and so on. And they recognize we're ahead of the curve. So I think that depends on the condition. There are many conditions in psychiatry where medications are sine qua non. They're absolutely necessary.
True.
And even within conditions where there's, you know, like major depression, it depends on the case. But again, to your point, I think it comes down to personalizing the assessment of the patient.
And the relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, we're on the same side, right?
Yeah.
But in obesity care, I mean, I think the medications have revolutionized, care of obesity, but I think we're not taking discussions about nutrition and healthy lifestyle and exercise out of the equation.
No.
So I think the risk with some of the dialogue around prescribing and deprescribing is that the psychosocial components of this are not well integrated into our care delivery, into our discussions around alternatives, around personalizing care. So I just think that, you know, making sure that we keep our eye on the ball, that this is probably multifactorial diseases, and probably the solutions are also multifactorial.
You know, something we should also keep in mind is when patients deprescribe, get to know your patient. And there's some medications that if there's an especially abrupt deprescription by the patient, the outcome is worse than no medication at all. I usually tell residents, okay, what do you want to give this patient with bipolar disorder? Oh, lithium. My next question is this patient going to be adherent to treatment? Because if they're not, in a way, lithium is more of a risk or clozapine, great drugs. But if they're stopped, especially abruptly, it actually is worse than no treatment. Getting back to personalizing the treatment, I think we need to get to know our patients.
Yes.
So a common scenario is that someone may be on Zolpidem, right, for years, and is no longer doing anything for them. They've become physiologically habituated to it and is really doing nothing. You know, they likely have tried to stop it on their own and were unsuccessful and very uncomfortable. And they're scared regarding the de-prescribing of something that is clearly not helping them. So I think a lot of education regarding that, and putting the patient in the driver's seat to drive the decrease over time, giving them the space to, okay, it's difficult. You had some difficulty before, now that you've told me, and let's stop it a little bit at a time and have the patient sort of guide us as to the speed of this that they're comfortable with. Another example is benztropine. Lots of use of benztropine in people taking antipsychotic medication where it's completely unnecessary.
Big problem.
Big problem, because it impairs cognition, for one thing. And patients are used to taking it. They probably tried to stop it on their own as well, and they felt very uncomfortable. And there's this reluctance, no, you can't take this away. Can't take my Ambien away. Can't take my Cogentin away. For a very good reason. They tried, didn't work out. And so we have to really do a better job at educating our patients and ourselves regarding the speed of stopping some of our meds. But prescribing under those situations is important.
So let me challenge you with a question. You have a patient like that, a benzo, a sleeper, and you want to take them off the medicine. And you slowly try to take them off the medicine, but you notice that the patient is resisting this. And how do you handle therapeutically the investment the patient has in the medicine for whatever the psychological meaning is versus your opinion the medicine ought to be tapered down? And so I can foresee that you get into a conflict with the patient, and that conflict then contaminates the entire treatment relationship.
Absolutely. You have to offer an alternative
yeah.
that will suit their needs. Thankfully, today we do have alternatives that are easier to use, I think, than a Z drug for sleep. We have a range of them now, and we do have alternatives.
Other
psychological. Yes, absolutely. CBTI, and it can be used if you can access it. And in terms of benztropine, if there is a drug-induced movement disorder that emerges, we have an alternative that won't impair their cognition.
So our colleagues have to keep up and be knowledgeable about emerging treatments in order to be able to provide comprehensive information.
So but for chronic insomnia, I just want to say, I'm sorry, but like for insomnia that's continuous for years, which is true for many patients, they have been on whatever, like a sedating medication for like multiple years, right? We see people like that all day, every day. Just changing them from one medicine to the other may be not an optimal solution. It may be an interim step. We have to find some other solution. And I'll just say one thing, like what I say to the patient, hey, listen, we're not in a hurry. You've been on this for 6 years or whatever. But we have to ask ourselves the question, what needs to be done so that you are not going to need something to knock you out for the rest of your life? Like how many years are we going to continue? Do you agree that this is a valid question? And then I look into, and then I don't want to take up the time, but we identify the various factors that led to this problem in the first place. Yeah,
does that happen?
Let me ask the question. So,
I want to interrupt you.
After you,
we have about after you.
I
want to get away from talking about drugs in which that people have a physical dependence, because that is not what we've been talking right. about in our deprescribing. Mm-hmm. And that's what some people are claiming, that drugs that really don't cause dependence, they're struggling to get off of those because of all kinds of multiple reasons. I want us to be able to talk about the medicines that don't have that those characteristics that people don't need to hold on to. And what we need to be doing is finding the right treatment for them, whatever it is. And if we've got them on something that isn't working, we need to go to the next step. And sometimes that means adding a medicine if they've had a partial response. And sometimes that means switching if they've had a poor response. And we're talking about things like depression, anxiety disorders. These can be either chronic or recurrent. And we can't just assume that somebody can be treated for a little while and then they'll be fine for the rest of their lives. And it's not about physical dependence.
Agreed. You know, we've talked about deprescribing. Do we know how to deprescribe? And my experience talking about deprescribing is, okay, I agree that we should consider it, but what is the right way to do it? Mm-hmm. Tell me if it's an antidepressant, if it's lithium, an antipsychotic, is it cutting it in halves? Is it the so-called hyperbolic way of deprescribing? What I'm sure all of you have been asked that question. Do we know how to do it?
And what's the safety net and the observation period that must accompany
yeah.
the event?
And something that we should do is actually to do more research in deprescribing. Mm-hmm. And when I say we, it's not only us, clinicians, academics, also industry. And the FDA would say should require when they approve a drug, now they require tapering up. Do they require tapering off?
They have actually.
Not to the extent that I would like.
No, absolutely.
And actually, for that matter, it is good for the, if you have a new drug, I've seen studies that they say, okay, you give the new drug, but you stop everything before that. And then a drug that would have been effective is not because of the withdrawal effects or whatever you want to call them out of the abrupt prescription.
You work in industry. How likely do you think it is that pharma would be interested in doing that?
Zero, unless the FDA requires it. So that's why it's not, we all want what's best for the public. So the FDA, of course, looks after the public. So they should require from industry studies that will be best for the public, including how to deprescribe, how to taper up. If the FDA doesn't require, or whatever regulatory agency in the world, it just won't be done.
So I'll play the cynical contrarian. Industry has no incentive to identify endpoints for which their product is no
longer correct. That's why it should be required.
Well, you know, on occasion, there's some scale used for withdrawal effects. And in the case of one antidepressant I have in mind, they actually said, you know, we observed something when people were on dose X of this medicine. So if you're going to stop this medicine, you have to decrease the dose by half and then stop. It's a very crude way of doing it. So it's not impossible to imagine the FDA, you know, doing something positive in this regard, because they've thought about it.
But actually it also helps industry, because again, if you are going to start and your new drug, you need to know how to prescribe other drugs. Otherwise, your study is going to fail. So it actually also benefits industry.
So there's room for education here. We have just a few minutes left. I'd like to ask each of you to look into the camera and speak to your colleagues who are looking for information. The camera's over here, actually. I don't want to rock the boat. My patient is not perfect, but the perfect is the enemy of the good. And if I start to make changes in my 15-minute visit, maybe, if the patient shows up, what you're asking me to do something that's potentially going to make the patient worse by bringing up a topic that I should just let it sit. Talk to me. Help me.
Yes, I would rise her up.
What I would say in that situation, and keep this very pragmatic, it's one thing for us to have a quixotic sort of fantasy views that things are going to change. It's not going to happen. I think, in fact, what needs to happen is something very practical. And I think what's practical is, first of all, when you sit with a patient, you got 8 to 10 minutes max. You say to the patient, look, I want you off this medication you shouldn't be on. I want you on medications you should be on. And we're going to take a calculation. What's the benefit? What's the risk? Why are we prescribing this treatment? And it's been my experience attempting to take people off medications I think they should be on. That process is going to take some time. 1 month, 3 months, 6 months. It's a relationship you build with the person. And I think most times, most patients, in fact, will have trust in someone who has their best interest in heart, and you just lay it open what they're doing. That fits into a 10-minute office visit for me.
You're here.
Yeah.
Raj.
I think that the perfect, we should not make the perfect the enemy of the good, which is sort of similar to what Roger is saying. So if we say that, you know, complicated medication regimen that developed over many years and that in a 15-minute visit, you should take a decision about what needs to be stopped, convince the patient and create a protocol, that's not what we are saying. We're saying you start discussing, you say, hey, maybe we should think about this. I noticed that you're on 3 antidepressants. We should talk about whether all 3 are needed. And as we go along, we'll talk about it. So if that's all you have time for, you've started a process, so it can take place over. So that's one thing. It could take 20 visits. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But at least you are working in the correct direction. And the other thing, which is a point that I made yesterday, I did a small presentation here at the ASCP annual meeting. And I was saying that we should ask ourselves, what is the priority? So if is the patient, what kinds of
effects from the psychiatric and non-psychiatric medications and complementary and alternative medicines taken as a whole, which effects are causing a big problem. If the person has alpha-1 antagonism, if several medications that are doing that and therefore develops orthostatic hypotension and fell down, well, then that is what we should focus on first and forget about the other stuff that we may postpone for a long time. Or if the person has over-sedation or urinary hesitancy because of muscarinic 1 receptor antagonism, we often see these patients who have like multiple medications that are anticholinergic. This is a very big problem in elderly patients, causing cognitive impairment, but also many other things. So bottom line, prioritization.
And don't overgeneralize. Such a good point. So this is where your pharmacological expertise comes in. It's not that medicines are bad. It's that you may be taking something conflictual. It also may be something conflictual with a non-psychotropic medication. So a good clinician can potentially step in and say, I can make you better. Anita?
I think the relationship with the patient is important. I think they need to be heard. I think you can ask questions so that maybe somebody else hasn't asked before. And then talk about the diagnosis, or potentially is the diagnosis they come in with the correct one? Plenty of people come in with bipolar illness as a diagnosis, and they've never had a manic episode or anything in their lifetime. And rather, they have other kinds of dysregulated systems and mood and other things, and their emotions are dysregulated. And I think going through and saying, well, this doesn't quite fit here, and potentially can we think about these things, and getting a diagnosis that they feel like, yes, you heard what I said. Yes, I've told you now. And then what are our options for treatment? So here we go. You could go to psychotherapy, and maybe your history of trauma puts you at greater risk. So we really should do that.
You have options.
Right.
That's a great message, Holly.
I'm just going to drill down a little further into what Anita is saying. I think you're absolutely right. We want to go back to basics and make sure that we're treating what we think we're treating. And I think utilizing screening tools much more routinely. So if someone's coming in with depression, they're not responding to antidepressants, we want to make sure that we're screening for bipolar disorder. If we're treating bipolar disorder and the emotion dysregulation is really sort of prominent, we want to do a screener for borderline personality disorder, maybe ADHD. But I think what we want to do is sequence this and be clear with the patient about how we're going to do this. So we're going to give them some screening tools to take home with them, to bring back, to send in through the messaging system, if that's available in your system. And then we're going to start doing in a systematic way, a reassessment of what's going on. So I think doing this in a scaffolded way and being clear with patients about what we're doing and why.
So wise. We have 2 minutes. Divide them equally.
I'll be relatively brief. I usually take a measure of the patient's receptivity or resistance to the idea. And the question I ask is, do you have any concerns about your medications or the number of medications you're on? That gives me an opening. If they say no, then I know my road is going to be a bit uphill. If they say yes, I know that I have an in, and I can then address which of the medications I would like to prioritize. You've heard all of the other considerations. My concern when we talk about psychopharmacology, as we talk to our colleagues in psychiatry, people get that concept. But again, remember, it's non-psychiatrists who are writing the bulk of these medications. And I can tell you, we have difficulty keeping in line all of the pharmacologic concepts. There's no way the other folks have any idea as to how to orchestrate this. So ask the patient, do you have any concerns with the number of medicines you're on? And that'll give you the in.
I think it's critical to not assume that they're actually taking these medicines. So in a large number of patients, I would expect it's hard to keep track of 8 different prescriptions. So what I often ask patients is, tell me about how you keep all these medicines straight. When do you take them? What reminders do you have to when to take them? And, you know, how often do you miss these medicines? I don't need an exact number, just a ballpark figure so we can sort of figure this out. And, you know, everyone misses their medicine from time to time. Even I forget to take my antihypertensive at times. So, well, let's talk about that. And then you get a sense of exactly what you're dealing with in terms of their level of adherence. And you may also discover during that time that they were taking their antidepressant on an as-needed basis, or they tried to take themselves off medicine X or Y and were unsuccessful. And you get a lot of information that way of stuff that they didn't really want to talk about, or they didn't think was important to talk about.
Last word.
We've talked about deprescribing, and the key thing is we need to decide what is best for patients. And it should be a team approach. Those of us who see patients, clinicians, every time we have a visit, we should consider, should we continue this medication or not? It's not that we should rush. Those of us who do research, research that we need, is actually on deprescribing. We talked a lot about the new drugs, but for the old drugs, do we know how to do it? No, we don't. And then in terms of new studies, we've mentioned in terms of industry, make sure that the studies that industry is funding takes the prescription into account. Meaning, if you're going to try a new drug, that the deprescribing of other drugs is done appropriately and not to have a negative study when your drug really works. So it's everybody working together, because at the end, what really matters is the best outcomes for our patients.
I can think of a few topics that are more important and timely and critical to our efforts in patient care than this one. So I am so grateful and happy to have the chance to meet with you all today. And I hope you who are listening have found this to be helpful and useful. Share this information. Let people know what we've had to say here today. It's an important national dialogue. You've had a chance to hear input from people that are at the cutting edge of science and medicine and technology in these areas. So we hope to see you back again very soon on the next episode of Brain Trust, Conversations in Psychopharmacology. I'm Dr. Joe Goldberg, and bye for now.
Who has led the deprescribing? Thank you, Joe.
There you go.
Yes. Team effort.
Thank you.
This podcast is presented by Psychiatric Times, the number one psychiatric publication in the U.S. Visit us at psychiatrictimes.com for the latest clinical news, expert perspectives, and CME opportunities. Thank you for listening.